On to case 10-1184, United States versus Manu Shah.
May it please the court, and good morning. This is not a Bluetooth. It just helps. I'm not waiting for an important call.
Listen, if you get one, answer it.
Mr. Shah pleaded guilty after having committed fraud. I know the court knows this, but it is so important to identify, delineate, what it is this appeal is and not about. He was sentenced. He does not appeal the sentence. Restitution was imposed. He does not appeal the restitution.
So I have a question for you, though, because, of course, we have two preliminary questions, one of which may be more evident than the other. First of all, the government has pointed out that I'll just say, at least with respect to Mr. Shah personally, there's a waiver of the right to appeal written in very broad language. The waiver covers
relating to.
Yeah, including any fine or restitution or the manner in which the sentence, including any fine or restitution, was determined. So my first question, and I'm going to tell you what they both are because they may be related, relates to why, at least with respect to Mr. Shah, we aren't, you're not out of court because of the appeal waiver. Now, my second question actually has to do with the timeliness of your appeal, because if I understand your theory, you're saying that as of the time Mr. Shah transferred the $5.5 million worth of securities to the court, which was the first deposits March 23rd, 2007, and the full amount is in there as of sort of May or so of 2007. Your position is that's payment of restitution. But that's, of course, long before the court enters its order of restitution. And under the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, Section 3663, capital A, the order of restitution in the case where some of the property has been returned has to reflect that property that's been returned. So either you think that he really owed $15.5 million, and so the 10 was what was left over, or what I think is more likely, you think he owed 10 and he'd already paid 5.5. The order should have been 4.5, and you should have appealed then, in which case you're either barred by the appeal waiver for Mr. Shah or you're barred for both of them by failure to take a timely appeal.
I'll discuss the first one perhaps first.
Okay.
Because it is the first. I don't know how one can waive. You can't. Something that hasn't even occurred yet. At the time
but it did occur. You said that that the payment had to be characterized as restitution. So
yes.
That had occurred long before the court entered the order.
He deposited the money.
Right.
I'm sorry. He pleaded guilty. He deposited the money. And the moment he lost the money, the second he deposited the money, before there was any loss, and there wouldn't be any diminution for quite some time after that, he immediately lost all control over it. By reason of the loss of the control, that payment was complete at that point, and there was no reason and nothing to appeal.
Very clear as of the time of the sentencing that the loss had already occurred and
yes.
that the court was not going to credit him for that full amount that he had deposited.
Actually, that wasn't clear until the government filed its lien. There was no such discussion ever until the government's lien came forward.
My question is related to Judge Wood's question, and that is, under what authority were you back in front of the district court? What was the basis for you to go back before the district court?
The filing of the government's intent to pursue the balance that was due. It was for the first time that Mr. Shah and his lawyers learned that they were looking for a deficiency in excess of not giving him credit for the $7 million he had deposited at that point. They were looking for $8.5 million instead of the $3 million that they should have been looking for, and that was the first heads up that he had in that regard.
And, you know, to add something else to this, the plea agreement expressly states that if there's anything left in the deposit account after restitution is paid, Mr. Shaw would get it back. So if the bull market had continued and the stock value, for instance, would have increased to $7.5 million, surely Shaw would have thought he was entitled to the benefit of the extra $2 million. And so it seems as if what is being sought here is only, you know, the upside of the deal.
Your Honor, he could not manipulate or control, as the Court suggests, because all control over all the assets have been taken away from him.
That's not my point.
But that's the response to the point, if I may. And that is, Your Honor is saying he was writing a wild bull, and the wild bull could take him to $7 million. But the answer is that was not anticipatable. That was not within his control.
It was anticipated, though. The language of the plea agreement says the remainder, if any, less the 10% accumulated interest should be returned to the defendant. So in other words, this wasn't just a payment. If it had been a payment to the victims, they would have enjoyed whatever increase in value the stock shares experienced.
And
instead, it says the remainder goes back to Mr. Shaw, which suggests it's just parked there as security until he makes a payment.
We did not make that point clear, apparently, in the briefs, and that's because at the time that the $5.5 million was deposited, it was unknown what the loss would be. The parties had made a best estimate.
But he controlled how he made that deposit, whether he would deposit cash or securities. Mr. Shaw could have sold those securities and deposited the $5.5 million.
Before he ever did anything,
right.
Except the plea agreement, and the Court specifically contemplated
gave him the option.
And anticipate. He had the option, but he had the option.
And he took
not
that
to.
Option.
In fact, the Court, even before any money was made, the day of the plea, or the day before the plea, no, I'm sorry, the day of the plea, even entered an order. If Mr. Shaw, and Your Honor knows where I'm going, deposited securities, they shall be held until further order of the Court. Court seized it upon itself, but I need to go back to this point. I'm sorry. I don't mean to skirt the Court, this side of the panel's question, but that's really very important and very key, and that is it was unknown what the amount would be because the parties were both working with their auditors and would for another 2 years, which is why we have
but
that.
But that struck me as the most ordinary of things. It's usually the case that until a full investigation has been made of these schemes, a final number doesn't get settled on, and the plea negotiations usually say that number will come only from the Court. We can't make any representations. And so I'm not surprised, except what I do want to come back to, actually two things. I mean, I've already said that under your theory, you should have been objecting the minute the $10 million number was there. But another point I'd like to raise is you say in your brief that Mr. Bursick repeatedly contacted the clerk to request that the securities be swapped out. But I didn't see in the record anything except this July 6, 2007 email exchange. And I also see no evidence in the record that you ever took the Court up on its invitation to file a plan for selling, for swapping out the securities. The judge on a number of occasions responds quite favorably, both in April 2008 and its sentence in 2009, to the possibility of a sale. And where's the evidence that you responded to that invitation?
Your Honor, the email strings between Mr. Bursick and the clerk of the Court are, and I will pull the docket numbers because they're in the record indeed.
And I don't know why Mr. Bursick is speaking for anybody. I mean, if Bursick to the clerk, it seems to me he a motion needed to be filed with the judge.
Right. The clerk yeah. can't speak for the court. The clerk conveying the intention of the judge, that's not how that's done. The judge rules in orders, not
but
through
the court,
what the
clerk says. The clerk did profess to speak on behalf of the court.
But
the
what
clerk,
you
no
see,
lawyer,
yeah.
No lawyer would be
no
a
lawyer.
I mean, Mr. Shaw must surely be wishing that he had had Duane Morris as his, you know, representing him at the time of the plea. But, you know, the lawyer he had at that time made a deal for him, and I fear he stuck with the deal that lawyer made.
There was also communication from the U.S. Attorney's Office to counsel, to Mr. Marconi, about the value dropping and how that's your client's risk. So that was well known before the sentencing.
Yes, of course it was.
So that would have been the subject of the appeal, you would think, if there had been appeal. And it comes back to my other question, what it is you're before the court on, that is not to amend the sentence, not to amend the order of restitution, but you're seeking you sought some determination of how restitution was to be applied. My concern is, do we have a final decision by the district judge on that issue? And if we don't...
By the district
you're not properly here.
You mean back at the sentencing time or back in December when the motion was filed?
In December and January, I think it's January 10th that Judge Scott ruled.
The motion
this year, is that a final order? Is that an interim assessment of how restitution may be applied? Until the final decision on restitution is made, isn't your appeal premature?
Well, the final decision was made, I believe, in December of 2009 when the lower court ruled that we would not be entitled to credit for the loss. That is the order.
And how is that any different than the ruling the judge made at the time of sentencing when the restitution order was entered?
Because it was not known then by Mr. Shaw and could not then be known by Mr. Shaw and wasn't even, there's no record that was even contemplated by the court.
He already knew the market had gone
but that
way mean, down. He already knew that he wasn't going to get credit for $5.5 million on the stock. He knew everything at the time of sentencing that he knew in December of 2009.
There is zero record, no record at all anywhere, that until the notice of lien was issued, that Mr. Shaw could or would ever be on notice that he was not being given credit for the entire $7 million.
He was requesting in his pre-sentencing filings a longer period of time to make the restitution payments so the market would bounce back further.
That was for the other $3 million, which has never been paid. I think I'm eating into my rebuttal time.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Hartzler.
Good morning. How are you?
Do you want to help him lower the podium?
I've got it.
Oh, you got it?
Wood, I know how to do this.
Okay.
I've been here before.
Other way.
It's just a...
Just bear with me.
Switch. There we go.
Thank you very much.
That looks a little more comfortable.
I appreciate it. The court is obviously aware of the facts in the record and it already made some of the points I want to make. So
could I just ask you a question? Does the record tell us who collected the dividends on the stock while the clerk held it?
There's nothing in the record about the dividends in the stock.
What was the form of the stock? Was it still in Mr. Shaw's name or was it put into the clerk's name?
I believe it was in Mr. Shaw's name only because you notice at the very end that Judge Scott entered an order requiring him to sign to endorse the stock so that it could be sold.
So the clerk held the certificates themselves in Shaw's name.
That's what I'm assuming. I mean, recall this was stock that was in a trust account and that the broker had to call for it to be released from the trust account and have the corporations issue the certificates. I'm assuming that they were issued in either the name of Mr. Shaw or in the name of the trust. But I assume it's Shaw because he then had the authority, presumably, to sign the certificates so they could be sold for the court by Merrill Lynch. And we know that there's some inference in there, but we know that because The court at the end ordered Mr. Shaw to make whatever arrangements were necessary to sell the stock.
The clerk was also required to invest the cash in an interest-bearing account.
Right.
And did not do that.
That's correct.
Has Mr. Shaw made any claim for credit for the interest that should have been gained on that, on the
I don't
the
believe
cash?
So. Not that I'm aware of, and I don't believe there's been any claim for that.
You know, Mr. Shaw made an argument that the math works only if you assume the stock should be valued when the clerk took control of it. His, you know, Mr. Hoffman says he's going to pay $500,000 every month for 6 months, and then there would be $8.5 million in the escrow. And that works only if the escrow already is worth $5.5 million.
That's right.
So the government didn't object to that. So how do you explain the math unless the party saw the stock as a payment of restitution?
You can't explain the math other than the parties understood that approximately $5.5 was deposited. It was not in a brokerage account, so the stock certificate sat in a vault with the district court. Because it is no longer in a brokerage account, there's not any kind of monthly statement or valuation of the stock. And as you can imagine, the clerk's not responsible for determining the value. I believe, Judge Wood, you looked at the email exchange and noticed that there's one point in which the broker asked the clerk, which, by the way, I agree, it was inappropriate for anybody to be relying on that communication, but, yeah, and problematic. Nevertheless, asked, well, should I put in another million, or because we've had an increase in value of 300,000, can it be less than a million? And the clerk responds, no, we expect a million. But I think that you can draw from that exchange that no one was tracking the value of this stock other than when the lawyers would come into court and report what the then value was. Judge
well,
Rovner,
actually, in that July 6, yeah. 2007 email, I think that's the one where Bursick says the value of the stock is up about $300,000, and he
right.
says if the value drops significantly, then I would have to get you more stock to make it up. Now,
right.
whether Mr. Bursick speaks for anybody other than Mr. Bursick is another question altogether, but he seems to understand that there's a value that needs to be in there, not a certain number of shares of stock.
I agree with that. Yes, he seems to understand that there's value, and then the clerk says, doesn't seem to know or appreciate that essentially we have a margin call possibility here and could have called for greater value. I'm sort of jumping around to try to come back to your question, which is I think that there was an assumption that this would be security deposit initially, by the assumption by the parties, and that this would ensure a payment ultimately of $10 million. But no one was tracking the value, and so there was not any exact math.
Mr. Shaw claims that the court twice thwarted his efforts to preserve the value of the deposit. I mean, that would seem to mean the funds were entirely relinquished and outside his control. So, you know, why not value them when he lost control? Did he have any control over
the stock certificates?
Yeah, once they're in there.
I think the record is unclear as to when they got signed over. The implication.
If that's the case, shouldn't he get the benefit of the doubt here?
Not if it's a security deposit, Your Honor. That wouldn't. I mean, for one thing, it's not a restitution payment for a variety of reasons. Restitution for the victims here was not going to be in the form of stock certificates. I mean, they lost money. This was a fraud in which Mr. Shaw and his company got, in effect, cash. So this wasn't like that Tyler case where there was timber that was recovered. It wasn't a recovery of stock certificates that were the product of the loss. The whole purpose of putting the stock in the account with the court was simply to assure that there would be payment at the end, that there would be money available. And,
so
and
was
by the
there
way,
any concern Mr. Shaw was going to move it all to Canada or something? I mean, what was accomplished by putting it in the escrow in the form of stock certificates as opposed to converting them to cash first, as Judge Finder pointed out, might have been done?
The benefit for the victims of the government? I don't think there was any. I think it would have been nice had it just been sold. I don't think I've seen a, I suspect the court has never seen a plea agreement in which you have a preliminary security deposit for payment of restitution that's in the form of stock certificates. I'd be very surprised if that provision was part of the initial draft of the plea agreement, but we don't have anything in the record about the negotiations or who provided that.
Now, what I don't asked you a couple of times, or invited Mr. Shaw a couple of times to suggest a plan for converting into money, right?
Right.
And was the government involved with that at all? Does the record show any effort to come up with such a plan? I mean, would the government have said, fine, you know, that sounds like a good idea to us? Or, you know, what?
Well,
she seems to assume this can't be done unilaterally by Mr. Shaw. It has to be a plan, she says,
right,
a couple of times.
Right. And ultimately, his attorney represented that they decided not to sell the stock because the market had declined pretty substantially.
Well, the market was starting to
come back
a bit, so I guess they decided why sell at the low point.
Right. Well, the market was starting to come back, but they were looking to extend the period of restitution payments so that the market could continue to come back.
Mm-hmm.
I think there would probably no negotiation or resolution or plan, as you suggest, largely because of the nature of the market. Notice, by the way, that after the stock is deposited, after the four deposits of stock, it is after that that the market starts to decline, and as a result, there's only cash at that point. So in answer to one of your questions, which I've, of course, lost sight of now, I would guess that there was no benefit for the government to allow a deposit of stock certificates as opposed to cash. It should have simply been converted to cash. But there was a potential tremendous upside to Mr. Shaw in that if he could take stock out of the trust account into his own name, presumably, and I'm not suggesting I understand the tax consequences of what that was, but his lawyer said it was a loan arrangement and they had to talk to the IRS. There was a significant benefit to Mr. Shaw in early 2007 when he was making these first initial three deposits, and that was appreciation of the stock. And we had seen appreciation in the stock market for half of a decade, at least, at that point.
As of the time the notice of appeal was filed, do we know how much Mr. Shaw was credited on the restitution obligation?
It's in a footnote in our brief, yes. It's not in the record, but by agreement of counsel.
The judge has recognized that as the credit amount. We know how much it sold for, ultimately, in March of 2010.
That's an excellent question, Your Honor.
But do we know what the judge is applying to restitution? I am concerned as to whether we have a final order here.
Right. I picked up that from earlier.
We know how much cash was paid in. We through your footnote, know what the ultimate sale return was.
No, I understand.
Do we know what the credit to restitution
is? Right. I do not recall whether or not it's in the record that the restitution was credited for the $3.775 million. Something tells me that was, and I think it's because of the correspondence between the court and our office, and I don't know that that's in the record.
Our court isn't going to want to be involved in interim determinations of credits against restitution. We want to rule on appeals from final decisions.
I thought this is a very good issue, as was the other issue that I haven't gotten back to of whether or not restitution should have been for. If the order should have been for 4.5. But I think that you're not going to get into the middle of whether or not there would be a restitution or this is a final order, because I guess from our view this was an enforcement action, a restitution enforcement action in which the judge valued those stock certificates. And I cannot tell you today whether or not ultimately, there was a credit for $3.775 million as a result of that sale.
You know, everybody sort of dropped the ball, didn't they?
Who's that? Who did?
Everybody. Everyone.
It could have been done more cleanly, yes.
I was wondering what we should make of the playing it by ear comment that the government made in June of 2009. It was quoted at page 16 of the reply brief.
Mm-hmm.
Where the government said, it is something I have never done before, so we're kind of playing it by ear, but whatever the court decides to do or however it decides to do it, we will go along with that. And I honestly don't know what the court decided to do.
Well, the court decided to value the stock as of the day of sale, is my understanding. That was the decision that's now on appeal. So,
yeah, but, you know, the exact amount, there just seem to be hanging questions.
Well, I don't think there's...
I started to say Chad's because of tomorrow, I guess. I don't know.
I don't think there's a question as to... Well, first of all, there's obviously no question that the judge ruled that there would not be a credit of $5.5 million. There's no question, I hope, that the district court, Judge Scott, decided Mr. Shaw should not receive credit for $5.5 million as a result of his deposit of those stock certificates.
Right, but how much?
Yeah, but how much?
So I'm trying to narrow this down.
It's not 5.5, and it's not 10, it's not 100, but what is it?
If this is a restitution enforcement action, then your waiver position on the appeal isn't going to apply because the district court does have continuing authority to make restitution determinations, right? Do you agree with that?
Restitution determinate? Of course.
Well, as to whether a restitution payment was made timely and whether restitution has been completed and so forth.
Right.
You would agree that the district court retains jurisdiction to do that, and the final rulings by the judge on those points can be appealed.
Correct.
You agree?
Correct. So what we mean, they can be appealed unless the issue is one of an interpretation of the plea agreement. This is an issue of interpretation of the plea agreement, and here we have a waiver of any and all issues relating to the plea agreement. And I wanted to address that because I think when you read from the section of, Your Honor, Judge Wood, when you read from the section of the plea agreement, for Mr. Shaw, it doesn't simply say he can't appeal any determination of sentencing or restitution. It also says he cannot appeal any and all issues relating to the plea agreement.
Right.
And
that's true for him. I actually
yeah,
have
thinking about engineering
with your understanding of companies, of Shaw Engineering's plea agreement, which is actually rather notable by not including
that
language.
Yes.
And in light of our Behrman case and others, I think that we might be right back where we started from, since there's joint and several liability between the two entities. So even if Shaw can't do it, the engineering company can.
Yes, but you appreciate the difference in the significance of whether you reach the merits with regard to the defunct engineering company versus whether Mr. Shaw has waived appeal. If Mr. Shaw has waived appeal, as we suggest, then he's going to be jointly and severally liable for the entire $10 million without a $5.5 million credit for the stock certificates. So that's really the one that has the most significance. I'm not trying to dispute. I do not dispute that there is a difference between the plea agreements. Obviously, we've said it. You can see that abundantly
and
clearly.
You argued there was waiver in both, and I'm just saying I don't think the argument was too strong when it came to Shaw Engineering.
And I'm not disagreeing with you. Yes, but it is exceedingly strong when it comes to Mr. Shaw. I've run out of time, but I did want to point out that if you look at the reply brief at the bottom of page 2, reading up to the top of 3, they define the issue as saying that this appeal addresses the government's and the trial court's post-indictment, post-plea reinterpretation of the manner in which the plea agreement is being enforced. And if he has waived, Mr. Shaw has waived any and all issues relating to the plea agreement, then this issue should be waived as a result of the plea agreement.
Right. And my focus on that sentence is the word being. It's still being enforced. We don't have a final determination here, is my concern.
Well, yeah, I wish I had enough foresight to see that beforehand. I think we saw this as a final decision relating to the valuation of the stock certificates that were placed as a security deposit to pay restitution. Now, did he receive from the district court credit for $3.775 million for which it was sold? You know, I happen to know that it did. Is it in the record? I don't know that. And I will, of course, go back and we can file a Rule 28J letter to advise the court or something to that effect. But if that's the case,
pardon me. That's Rule 28J. That's really supplementation of the record on appeal.
I love coming up here. You know, you learn so much. Yes. That's right, of course.
Oh, so do we.
Yeah.
Well, I'll ask for permission of the court at the appropriate time should I be able to discover that there's something in the record, or we can supplement the record. So I will try to do that. But pardon me for asking, but is that really, will that then satisfy your question about the enforcement and what point we are? Because I don't think that we would have to wait until we've collected the $10 million. That could be a long time coming. So if there was a credit for the of $3.775 million from the sale of that stock, then I would think that the judge's order saying the value that Mr. Shaw will receive will be the value as of the date of the sale of this stock brings this whole issue to a head and to a conclusion, and I think could be interpreted as a final order that therefore could be appealed. Mm-hmm. Now, that does not address Judge Wood's initial question, but as I understood it, you were suggesting that the restitution, that the moment at which the appeal time clock would start would be at sentencing, when the judge should have...
If it had been a prepayment of 5.5 out of the $10 million, then the restitution order should have said $4.5 million mm-hmm. under 3663 capital A, B, whatever it is, 1, little 2.
But I think, actually, and I'll check that as well, I believe the restitution order, the final order would have to be for $10 million with a credit for 5.5.
That's not what the statute says, but maybe if I don't know, Judge Rogner, whether you'd like the parties to address that statute.
I think we should, don't you?
Yeah. Rather than try to do this on the fly.
Right.
We can have both sides address.
How much time do you want?
I've got a couple of briefs still. I can 30 days. What do you suggest? Huh?
Sure. Well,
I don't know. I mean, if you need it shorter, I can do it in a week.
Well, how about 21 days? Will that be helpful?
That's fine. That's fine.
I don't know. Yeah. That's fine. 21 days.
Very
simultaneously.
Well. And I thank you for giving me some extra time. I hope I've addressed
that. No, I'm going to give Mr. Hoffman just as much.
Oh, well, then no, thank you.
So I don't blame you. In fact, I think I'll give him more. No. All right. How much extra time? About 20 minutes? What did we get here?
I won't need a lot of time.
4 extra minutes? So what's that on top of what he had? What?
Well, he's already spent.
No, for rebuttal.
The
10 minutes. You have 10 minutes?
I'll try to not use
use whatever you need. No joke.
I've got a couple of 50 points in response to Mr. Hartzler, I hope. And first of all, the court started questioning Mr. Hartzler on the issue of had the certificates, when they were first delivered, been signed over. The answer is no. In fact, that's why you have repeatedly in the trial court's orders directions to him to sign on the dotted line, i.e. sign them over, whenever he's asked to do that.
Well, then that makes it very difficult to perceive them as restitution payments if the clerk couldn't do anything with them. But hold
them. Okay, but then the court has anticipated my next point, and that is I direct the court to United States versus Rosebush. Again, a Fed sub case out of the state of Wisconsin, but the transfer of securities, even if there is no corresponding change, it's the closest we could come, on the books of the issuing corporation, does not mean they don't, that ownership of those, even though not signed by the owner, actually, that's not quite what Rosebush says, but even though not changed on the books of the issuing corporation, would not prevent them from being transferred to the new owner. In this case, I guess it would be the court and the court's clerk as holding agent for the victims until time of distribution. Rosebush goes one step further. Rosebush then also says, but whether or not ownership transferred, one has to look to the intent of the parties. And the intent of the parties couldn't be clearer to me, at least, than the fact that repeatedly the lower court said, I'm taking control. Nobody's going to do anything with these securities or this cash until further order of the court.
What gives me the concern, because if Mr. Shah really came to a point, and it appears on several occasions he did, where he thought, I better convert these shares into cash because I see the market is tanking, why didn't he go back to the court and get the court's permission to do that? I don't see that the government would have stood in your way at all. And the problem is, which is this big absence of a record. I just don't understand why the judge wasn't asked.
Actually, it's quite consistent. First of all, he did do it.
And he didn't go to the judge.
No, he didn't go to the judge.
I mean the judge, the Article 3 person sitting in the front of the room.
I would dare say, given the strong language of the clerk to Mr. Brissett, he was swatted once and he wasn't going to go back and get swatted a second time.
But the clerk isn't the person who runs the courtroom.
But you're talking to lay people here. You're not talking to
Shah was represented, though.
That's part of the problem, isn't it?
Pardon me?
That's the problem, isn't it?
But the other point here is that when they were all before the court on April the 29th, there was an approach in that direction. And even then, the trial court said, if you and the government can work something out, I'll entertain it. Court says what? I'll entertain it, making it manifestly clear. The court recognized the diminution of the shares and recognized that it, the court, was going to control any amount.
I don't find that so shocking, to tell you the truth. Mr. Shah had pleaded guilty to all sorts of fraudulent acts. It's not uncommon for courts to see people who've done that move assets around, to transfer them to other people, to make them harder to find. All kinds of things can happen. And so for the court to think, I'm not just going to leave it up to Mr. Shah, strikes me as a very rational thing for the court to do. And the court, you tried to make in your brief something of using this word, I'll entertain it, as though that meant the court was going to say, I'm going to say no, but I don't read it that way at all.
Actually, Mr. Shah's not making that motion, if you want to talk about being consistent with anything, it is consistent with his recognition that when he paid over the $5.5 million in securities, that was it. It was over.
Was he nagging the court to let him do something? You can't have it both ways here.
Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't have the court divest him of any authority of it over it and then also hold him liable.
Well, but according to your theory, then, the fact that he's asking the court repeatedly for some permission to, or the clerk anyway, some permission to change things is recognition that he knew he wasn't on solid.
Not repeatedly, just once, and it was at the very beginning.
Okay.
And he's not really asking to liquidate them either, though. He's asking to swap them out. These are pretty good stocks. I want to take these out and put these others
for the purpose of maintaining overall value. Indeed, yes, I would argue with that. Thank you for all your time.
Well, thanks to both counsel for a very well argued appeal.